IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 97 of the Killing It Podcast, and the boys are back in tune. I think some of that has to do with the fact that Ryan is off in the high seas.
Yes, and I will say to every human who is listening to the sound of my voice, embrace the everywhere economy and work remote because it will save your life. And I'm literally not exaggerating here, but we are coming to you on recording, but for this session live from Hawaii, because the COVID monster between here and there was much better managed on this end than that end. And I'm still working, doing full office hours, but doing it within line of sight of the beach out there, and it's 81 degrees and magical.
Which is making me intensely jealous as it's
exactly
with freezing in the nation's capital. And
so I'm exactly halfway between you guys geographically and with weather. So I'm a little jealous, but not as jealous as Dave.
Yeah, you do still have California weather that is very pleasant all through the winter. But I will say, as we are speaking, it's snowing in Seattle. And it only does that just like once a year or so. And when it does, this is a population of very unprepared people. And the drivers in Seattle, when it snows, thank you very much, don't go there. It's not,
well, especially safe with all those hills. I was actually stuck in a snowstorm there. I guess it was about 96, 97. Anyway, no one knows how to drive, and then you put it on a hill and you forget it.
Yeah, it is. It's just as vertical as San Francisco, except it occasionally snows. And when it does, those that have been there, you know, like the phenomenon is people will drive until they slide. And when they slide, they will get out of their car and leave it precisely where it is, including right in the middle of a boulevard that is supposed to be having traffic. People just, nope, it's not safe. I'll get out and walk away from my car and I'll come back and get it when it thaws. That is not wise, Seattle. Not the proper response to snow driving.
So you're there. I've got some weather in Sacramento. We just had a monster storm and 68,000 of my neighbors are without electricity. So if I disappear, I'll come back on the phone.
We'll know what it is. And me, it's just more of the same. But hey, nothing's on fire this particular week.
Hey,
so we'll take it.
Silver lining.
Things are trending upward. But with that, we should thank our sponsor. We are sponsored this week by the fine folks at Mobius Connect. Mobius Connect by Gazinta. It's the easiest way for ConnectWise Manage and QuickBooks Online to connect. Keep invoices, expenses, and inventory automatically updated right from Manage to QuickBooks Online and payments right back into Manage. With simple pricing, set it and forget it auto-sync, Mobius Connect delivers with no restrictions on the number of invoices, expenses, and payments. And it plays well with others like Connect Booster. Trusted by over 1,000 MSPs now, and with a personalized onboarding process, go to Mobius-connect.com to try it out for free and tell them the guys from Killing It sent you.
All righty. So last week we talked about SpaceX and some amazing cool stuff they're doing. And so I want to follow up this week with Alphabet deciding to get out of the business of trying to put balloons up in the air to provide internet connectivity. And that's somewhat of an interesting story, but I am interested in what it represents, which is kind of the bigger picture that private companies are taking on some challenges that normally we would have left to governments, right? You want to put internet connectivity to an entire continent? That didn't used to be a thing that private companies could take on. And now there's so much money and the earnings reports from all the big guys are coming out, and turns out, as Dave would say, they have all the money.
Well, they do have the money. What was interesting to me was they found that the viability of it was not enough to justify the business expense. This was a balance of, it's not that it's a bad idea, it's that their thinking was there would be the ability to deliver it at a certain price point, which would open up markets that they couldn't necessarily serve. And the math didn't work. They weren't able to get it to the cost that it made sense to deliver the service based on what they were able to sell for it. So this isn't a saying, oh, this kind of technology is bad. It's saying, well, it doesn't balance out there. I'll put my hat on for a moment and go, yeah, shocking. A utility may not necessarily be the way that you're not necessarily looking at it from a full, we will make enough money off of it perspective, for the same reason that in some cases, you know, selling water and electricity may not quite work the same way. It reinforces my thinking of, this is a utility, guys. We need to be thinking about broadband as a utility. And this is some of why, because it is difficult when you just make the math to tie the two together to fully justify it.
See, but this, and I will take that one step further. God bless a serious R&D budget, right? Like, this is not on paper and technologically. I've been reading about this balloon solution as an interested bystander for a couple of years. And on paper, it makes perfect sense. It is surprisingly stable internet service, right? My thought is, I've put a balloon in the air before. I've watched it float away. That's completely uncontrollable. Hot air balloons, the general itinerary of a hot air balloon ride is, we're going to go up and we're going to go down. And in between, it's not up to us, right? Because there are prevailing factors. But this internet service, you put it high enough, you can make it stable enough. They actually made the technology work, which on paper is interesting. In practice, that's absolutely fascinating, but economically, it's not viable at the level of utility price points. You couldn't have done that in concept. You can't simulate that experience and that technology adaptation on just a minor level. Somebody like Alphabet, with all the money in the world, had to go out there and try this thing. And now that they have, there's a way to dial it up and charge more. There's a way to dial it down or use other delivery mechanisms, but they have radically advanced the technology conversation simply because they had the money to go try this.
Well, and you know, with a tip of the hat to the R&D market, it is cool that people can come up with these totally whack job ideas and there's enough money to try it out. Like, oh, I know, why don't we just land a rocket upright on a floating platform in the ocean? Okay, hey, Bob, why don't you get on that, right? And this is a similar kind of thing. It's not actually, the interesting thing for me about this, it's not dependent on bandwidth, right? If you can get this balloon thing to work, it'll work with one gig as well as it will with 100 gig. So it's just a matter of trying to figure out, as you say, what are the variables that matter and is there a payback? I don't know, Dave, if it needs to be a utility, if somebody else can do it in outer space a good alternative.
I love the way Ryan said it. Somebody has to do this. And you also talked about the investment in an R&D budget. So first off, we have to make sure that the ecosystem has enough experimentation going on in it to drive innovation.
True.
The somebody can be private, it can be public, and it can be both. Let me observe, we went to the moon on public dollars. Like, we went to NASA took us to the moon based on, and we all got the benefits of the investment in the technologies that came out of that. Also, it can be private companies that come up with these ideas and experiment. We've seen tons of innovation here. Just because it's one or the other doesn't mean it's only that. And I look at this and say, what we're learning is it's about making sure that the innovation dollars are really there.
Well, and see, this is where I'll go back to, if you've not read about this, there, Clay Christensen wrote a book a number of years ago where he was talking about the three horizons of innovation, and where the model is horizon three is this kind of stuff. It's way out there. It's not economically viable. We're figuring some weird stuff out and playing with science fiction. Horizon one is the next version of the stuff you already have deployed and you need to upgrade for feature function advancements. Horizon 2 is the problem, right? Horizon 2 is there's no shortage of whiz bang stuff. There's no shortage of linear leapfrog upgrades, but there is a serious shortage of people who can take the cool stuff and make it a viable business model. This is where our industry, where I think that the solution provider layer of our industry is so absolutely vital. A big manufacturer developer like Alphabet can go out there and test the science fiction. An IT department can manage an upgrade cycle. But in between, there's somebody that needs to say, that's either a business or it's not. Either I can make a living selling, integrating, supporting those kinds of technologies, or it doesn't matter what the functionality is, right?
Well, there has to be a business. In any industrial revolution, which this, I mean, we really are in with many, many technologies, there's a lot of stuff where people say, okay, I can't do the big thing. Like I personally, I can't afford a satellite. Right, I can't even afford one balloon, let alone 1,000.
Yeah. Amex, yeah, but, dude, Amex.
Even if I bust out the credit cards, I still can't afford that one satellite. But I can help retailers figure out robots. I can help with one little piece of technology. There are so many things we've talked about in this program just in the last few months about, you know, data centers at the bottom of the ocean and, you know, driverless cars and delivery systems. And all of those things can be advanced by somebody doing one little project for one client and saying, hey, you know, I think that there's a business model here, right? Yep. Because those are the things that make it real, is turning it to solve actual problems for actual clients in the real world.
And I'll close this out by making it a little bit tactical for people. Remember, there's a reason to have some R&D experimentation budget to play with ideas, is to try some of these things. Fail fast. I'm not saying pour tons of money into something that doesn't work, but you've got to make sure that you're investing a little bit to make sure that you're catching your version of that next big idea. Now, I'm going to move us on to the next one because it's one of my favorite things, where it's, let's debate a word. Let's discuss the meaning or something. So those who know, I do another podcast called The Business Tech. I do tons of reading on industries to try and figure out trends and report on them. Occasionally, stories cross my desk from other industries where I go, this is a bigger thing. I've been tracking the AV, audiovisual space, through a publication called Commercial Integrator for a while, to watch what they're up to because it's related to our space, similar ideas. And they posted a opinion piece around why they call them integrator is the best word for what we do. And I was sharing the link in the show notes because I loved this, because it was their advisory board talked about all of the companies doing communications, life safety, security, network infrastructure, AV, low voltage. And the word they came up with to classify themselves was integrator. Guys, I'm coming to you going, like, we've been screwing around with names to talk about who we are, solution providers, IT services providers. They came up with one word that, like, instantly made a whole bunch more sense for them. Like, I like their word. Why can't we do that?
Well, some of our listeners are IT integrators.
Yep.
But to my mind, integrators are different from solution providers. And
okay,
we literally did start this show at a cabana in Vegas talking about, does the term managed services mean anything? So, to me, when I think about solution providers, they do more than integrate. Integrators, as a rule, take some known good technology and they plug it in and make it work. And there, you know, I'm not saying there's no creativity there. Trust me, if you've tried to get a Sonos system to work over a wireless network, it's not an obvious or easy thing, especially when you've got two or three different kinds of computers and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
There's problems that have to be solved. But at the end of the day, it's a known piece of technology that you're putting together. That's different from what we were just talking about, which is trying to take technologies and say, what solutions can come from this? What new and interesting things can be done with it? And I think most of the IT service providers are providing their greatest value when they're providing solutions rather than integrating hardware or software.
Well, except that, so I will flash back to a previous life a number of years ago where I put together a presentation at a big industry conference that was basically, well, it was on this topic, and our basic thesis was, don't tell me what they call themselves, tell me how they get paid. And then I know whether or not we're talking about the same kind of an animal with a different descriptor or a fundamentally different kind of an animal. Because as we all know, right, like there once was a time they called us resellers, and then we all went, pshaw, don't you dare call me a reseller. I'm a value-added reseller. And then I became some other flavor, and eventually we call ourselves service providers, technology solution providers. And I do believe that the terminology, it began with good intentions to describe the activities within your business model, but then everybody basically calls themselves a total solution provider when that's not actually what they get paid to do. I agree with you, Carl. I think that the value is not in just reselling the product, not just in plugging it in and making it do what it was specified to do, but to look at the world of the customer and say, there's an interesting problem over there that nobody's figured out how to solve. Can I take off-the-shelf components, build them together in a way that will solve a problem you could not previously solve with this technology? I think the word integrator is a very valuable thing because we can cross legacy boundaries of industry categories, right? Like you sell security and I sell storage. Somebody needs to make the storage secure, right? Like there's an integrator responsibility there, but I am much more interested in getting paid for the related services around any of those things than I am the margin or the markup on selling the thing.
Okay, so I'll buy that. It's just, I guess the other bit about it that I sort of loved was, well, they came up with one word. We always come up with three words or acronyms or like they literally just took the time to say, we're going to just come up with a word that makes sense. And I think there's a certain degree of simplicity that their approach to this that we could learn from in the way that we talk about these ideas, what we're building, particularly when we look outside to talk to the people that matters, the customer. We have all of these debates internally about like what is, what isn't, when ultimately it doesn't really matter if the customer doesn't believe it or the customer doesn't talk about it that way. And I like the simplicity, right? Like I like that element of, yeah, maybe it's not as eloquent an academic argument, but man, a customer will remember that. Like, will remember the word, and it's simple, and it's something that makes sense to them. It's not three letters, and not an acronym.
I think that I would actually go the other direction, which is to say, a customer will understand it enough for me to sell against it. For example, if you've got a system that is security in the sense of physical security. You know, a keypad at the door and alarm bells and little things on the windows, right? That needs to be integrated into the other technology that's going on. But what I want to provide is a different kind of security that has to be architected, and it requires more than installation with a certain level of skill. It requires some design elements and actually ways of potentially providing the client with additional benefits that they didn't originally see. I will say, to your point, Dave, the vendors love to think of what we do as integration, no matter how complicated it is, right? Here's right. HIPAA compliance in a box, chunk, right? Why don't you go integrate that? Because the world's not that simple.
See, but that's the thing, right? I think you're right on the right target, Dave. In a world where the decision to purchase this stuff is made by a technology-friendly expert, then we can be as academic and deep and detailed as we want in the description. But that's just not the world we live in anymore, selling and supporting technology solutions. Our world is now defined by, yes, it will be influenced and supported by the IT department, but it will be purchased more often than not by somebody outside of the IT department, somebody who does not know the nuances, cannot understand the details of the technology, and is looking at you like, if you give me a white paper to explain why I should pay you, I will never pay you. But if you can give it to me in mass market eighth grade terminology, I'm about to sign up because that sounds easy. It's never easy. That's why we get paid. And never forget, Carl, the guys who make all the money in the applications world, they're not the people who sell you that SAP or Microsoft Dynamics license. It's the integrator who does the customization around that stuff, right? So that's where the money is.
Cha-ching!
Follow the money. All right, very good.
Always following the money. But, and you know, we try to have themes in our program, and we try to talk about some of the big ideas that we will come back to many, many times and talk about what's good and bad about them in the moment. But also, we want to talk about progress. So our next topic is talking about what I believe to be a very encouraging sign of progress. The specific topic is a new artificial intelligence chatbot product that was patented by our friends at Microsoft and then taken off the market. And we're going to have a really fun discussion about whether or not this is a good idea. But what's the takeaway that I have here from this topic is that the people who invent things often don't think about whether they should do what they can do. They only think about whether it's technologically possible. And in this case, our friends at Microsoft, they considered the should question, and it was really important. So I'll let you guys kind of get into
Ryan, you're burying the funny slash creepy. We have to actually take this on. Like, yeah. So let's talk this out. They patented a chatbot that would let you talk to dead people. Like, they would let you create personalities of chatbots based on social media bit, and they were really running it on like people that had died as one of the bits. And the best quote from the CNN article is from the GM of the division, who said, you know, that he acknowledged the other internet users saying, quote, "Yes, it's disturbing." And you're like, yeah, that's a little creepy, guys. Like,
so to me, this falls into the category of the future's already here. It's just not widely distributed. So everybody knows we got deep fakes, deep fake videos, and so forth. Microsoft was wise enough to patent the collection of these technologies such that you could recreate a person, living or dead, or even fictional, and create a two or three dimensional model of this person, including their behaviors, their voice, and so forth. So I can see where people would be creeped out. We were talking about this before we started pushing the record button. I could see where you'd be creeped out if this was somebody you knew, like if your relative recently passed and suddenly here's this thing on your chatbot that sounds like them, that would creep you out. But if it's a historical character, if it's Abraham Lincoln, I don't know that it's that creepy. Or if it's a famous actor whose family says, hey, we can license her voice, and you know, you can have Katharine Hepburn on your voicemail.
We could finally solve the debate of what would the founding fathers say. We'll just create a chatbot and
say whatever we want them to say.
But look, here's the bit that's in this story that I want to highlight, because I think this is the actual bit. Is they filed the patent in 2017, prior to their creation of an AI ethics board, which then reviewed it and it was part of the conversation about going, yeah, not so much. And I think that's the important other detail. There's the funny detail I brought, but this is the actual reason we wanted to highlight the story, was the fact that, look, they have put on that moral ethics hat and said, we're going to look at our technology and say, not only can we do this, but should we do this, as Ryan alluded to. And they now have a formal process for reviewing it. And in this particular case said, yeah, not so much, because of that process. And that's the improvement.
And that is 100% the thing that I wanted people to take away, right? Can we do this? Yes. Is it getting more and more believable with deepfakes and with all of this? Yes. Does the AI layer of the chat, it's not scripted, it's not an actor, right? Like, this is not what I think that person would have said. It is all that artificial intelligence to parse out what that person most likely would have said in the scenario. And that was the frontier too far, where the ethicists went, ooh, weird, don't do that. And the industry progressed. I find that to be very reassuring, because of all the weird stuff we could do with AI, there are now professionals who are thinking about whether we should.
So
I think that's great.
I always like having the ethical discussion, but I have to say the genie's kind of out of the bottle. And just because Microsoft was the first one to get the patent doesn't mean there aren't 42 other companies capable of doing this. Or will be capable of doing it in the next week or so, right?
Yes.
So bigger question is, how do you draw those lines ethically and say, well, you know, what makes this creepy? What makes this not creepy? It's kind of like pornography, right? I know creepy when I see it, but I'm not sure I could define it.
Well, and that's a good point, because you don't want to wait until after to say, the conclusion is we should not have done that, because there are some genies you cannot put back into the bottle, right? There will be consequences to these things, and we should draw the ethical lines that prevent you from doing it before. It's that prior restraint concept, which I understand exactly why there are so many legal problems with that approach. But I mean, don't get this too theoretical, right? A month or two ago, this was demonstrated in almost real time. We all only heard about it in the media, because when Kim Kardashian went off and had her birthday party on the remote island and invited in all of the people, the birthday present that she got from Kanye West was a three-dimensional hologram of her deceased father doing the things that he did. And they all said, oh, it was lovely. And when I read that story, I went, there's another reason I would never be able to have a conversation with that family of people, because I don't think that's okay. I didn't think that was sentimentally interesting. I thought it was weird as hell, but people are doing it. And so now's the time the industry needs to figure out, not just should not have done that, sorry for the consequences, should not do that in the future. Here are the rules by which you should abide.
Right. Well, I'm encouraged by the fact that we're having the conversation, and it has become at some level proceduralized in the companies that are creating that. That's the takeaway at a high level, is that we're now having it. Whether or not we perfected the line, now we're capable of having the conversation because we're at least looking at it.
We acknowledge there's a line. We just have to figure out where it is.
Where it is. And by the way, that may change, and ideas change over time. But by starting to put into place the mechanism to have the conversation, we're getting there. Before, we didn't even have that. So I would say, like, you know, kudos to Microsoft for this. Other organizations need to embrace that way of thinking too, again, so that we can have the conversation, because if you don't have the mechanism to do it, you're not going to get anywhere.
Right. Well, you know, I think back about some technology, some research where we would never do it today. You know, Jonas Salk, you know, poking his kid with the pox, right? So, you know, I think that it's good for us to have this discussion. I would like to see, maybe this, we'll do this on our 100-episode wrap up, a discussion of where this fits in the contract for the web, right? Because I think that there's an emerging sense of ethicism, if that's a word, ethics among very big companies. And, you know, if they don't do it, you know, somebody else is going to, right? So I'd much rather have the companies regulate themselves at some level rather than have arbitrary rules pushed down from organizations that may or often don't understand the technology.
Amen. We have lived through the consequences of that for the last, what now, 25 years in a very specific instance. I think the industry should be thinking forward like this. And like you, Dave, I'm very encouraged to see that there's evidence of people who pay attention, there will be an arms race in artificial intelligence. We've heard for years that whoever gets to fully realized artificial intelligence first will control the world. So everybody's going, good actors and not so good actors. I think the more that we can highlight the ethical boundaries, the easier it will be to control potential bad actors with emerging technologies. So when I started this one, I was deliberately trying to keep the woohoo factor out of the story and focus on the advancement in artificial intelligence. But of course, the only reason it's interesting to talk about is because it's weird.
Oh, exactly. The weird stuff. Like, I mean, they're talking about talking to dead people. Of course, this isn't like, we got to bring that up. That's why.
I would love to talk to Abraham Lincoln. I do not wish to have a dearly departed relative applied in this.
Tell you, we're going to answer the question of the founding fathers. That's now what I want them to build me a chatbot where I can go ask.
Then the question is, who's going to write the algorithm and what?
Exactly. And it goes on and on and on.
And on and on.
Well, perhaps we haven't solved this today, but we'll solve it another time, because that will do it. We're now finished with episode 97 of the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.